Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room, the speaker will be Sarah Forth. And the title of her topic today is Responses to Evil in Annie Dillard. So let's listen in on Sarah.
I didn't build this class as Women's Responses to Evil, thinking that folks might think it's just women's only. And I'm not even particularly claiming that women have unique responses to evil, although because women's experiences are different, I think we may see evil, theorize it differently, may respond to it differently. I'm not making any kind of absolute claims, but that was my interest, to find out how women respond to evil, because I'm a woman and I'm concerned about living ethically in an unjust world. I teach at a small graduate institute in a program in feminist spirituality, so this is the kind of thing that I get to do a lot of. As I said, I'm finishing my doctorate in theology at Garrett Seminary and Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Let me say just a few words about using literature as a source of theological reflection. I won't say too much about this, but if you're a pastor or teacher and would like to talk more about this area methodologically, I'd be glad to have a conversation with you at lunch or coffee break, but we'll just be doing it. I prefer to have a hands-on approach rather than spend a lot of time theorizing. Literature as a source of theological reflection. One ethicist suggested that narrative, that is, storytelling, help makes our moral actions intelligible. That is, it reveals our intentions by placing us in a context. One theologian talked about how narrative keeps in solution the language, belief, and life we are called to, and hence it addresses people totally. Often theologians start with biblical materials to do theological or ethical reflection. I don't exclude that from the work I do, but I find that in literature, and particularly for me, women's narratives, provides that context, that real-life experience that leads to, for me, the kinds of solutions or suggestions of possibilities for action in this world. I also like to work with stories because stories fuel the imagination, and how can we recreate our world without imagination? One of the priests who works with troubled teenagers in East Los Angeles, which is primarily a Latino area with a lot of gangs, talked about how many of the young people he worked with couldn't envision a future for themselves, and hence the present wasn't made possible for them. So I like stories also because they fuel the imagination. About evil, I'm going to say a few words, because even though we think we know a lot about evil and we may engage in it in varying ways, it might be good to come up with a common definition for ourselves. Rosemary Ruther talks about evil as lying in a distorted relationality that destroys both sides of the relationship. Distorted relationality. And usually, or often, theologians distinguish between moral evil and social evil. Moral evil being that which occurs when some agent causes pain or fails to alleviate it when he or she is clearly in a position to do so. And I think what's important to catch in that definition is when he or she is clearly in a position to do something about it. The difficulty, as we probably know, and perhaps what drew you to these sessions, is that evil is often very ambiguous and very complex, and knowing what it lies within our power to do is often very difficult. Social evil is often described as patterns of relationships that are directed toward the denial of human dignity and value of some human beings for the benefit of other human beings. That's about all that I'm going to say about evil in the abstract, because I think evil only becomes real when it assumes a human face, and that's what narrative helps us do. Now, in the work that we're going to look at today, Annie Dillard's Holy the Firm is about what used to be called natural evil, actually it's a problem of suffering rather than the question of evil. I prefer to think of the kind of suffering that we're dealing with in Holding the Firm, which by the way involves a young child who was burned in a plane crash. And the book is about Annie Dillard trying to come to terms with how it is this child is so badly injured, and how it is that we can talk about a good and a just and omnipotent God if we can also have this kind of suffering in our world. So really this is a prelude to the rest of the classes, because I think that trying to deal with the issue of suffering and how it is that God allows suffering is critical before we can go on to the next step, which is talking about situations in which we may be culpable or may feel some responsibility. I think it's a preliminary discussion that we need to have. So let me say a little bit about Annie Dillard, since some of you have read her and some of you are less familiar. She's a Anglo-American writer who published in the 70s a book called Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, which was a recounting of a year that she spent observing the natural world and reflecting on that. It's part natural history, it's part autobiography, it's part theological reflection, it's part history. It's an absorbing account. This book won her the Pulitzer Prize. She was only 26 years old, and she became something of a literary celebrity. Although much to her credit, her response was not to go on the TV circuit, but instead to retreat to a cabin in the woods in Puget Sound and think about what it was that she was doing and the nature of her success and what her life was like as an artist. And many of her musings show up in her book, Holy the Firm, which was her next book published. Pilgrim at Tinker Creek was a rather dense book. It's only maybe between 200 and 300 pages, but it's very thickly textured. There's a lot of stuff in there. Holy the Firm, by contrast, is a mere 76 pages long. It started out actually as a poem, and it's often elliptical in that way that poets are. There's a lot of teasing apart of meaning and images that we can do in this book. The characters, well, there's primarily one character, and that's the narrator, Annie Dillard. You can't always assume in a literary work that the narrator is the same person as the author. The author is projecting a certain persona to us that we call the narrator. But the narrator and Annie Dillard, in this case, coalesce pretty closely. She describes other people whom she encounters, but there's not really dialogue or interaction. She describes it. So the entire book is really Annie Dillard thinking about these problems and thinking about her world and the nature of suffering and God's relationship to the world. Her primary question is God, how do we explain suffering? Is God in touch with anything? Or, as she puts it, is time on the loose? Let me say a little bit more about how the book is structured. And then I brought along one short segment out of her narrative. It was a piece that she actually published separately as an essay, and it encapsulates a lot of the questions that she wants to ask. As I said, the book is about her life, 3 days in her life spent in her cabin in Puget Sound. The book is divided into three parts, and each part is a particular day. And the tone of the first part is very exuberant. It's called Newborn and Salted. The opening of the book reads like this: every day is a god, each day is a god, and holiness holds forth in time. I worship each god, I praise each day splintered down and wrapped in time like a husk of many colors spreading at dawn, fast, over the mountains, split. when she talks about gods, she uses lowercase g. And she explained in an interview sometime after this book was published, is that by that she means each day's holiness and the kind of holiness that we encounter. So she's celebrating what she sees as the holiness of each day. But for her, at least as she represents it, she doesn't quite connect this yet with her larger understanding of God, as we see as we go through the narrative. She introduces us to her life. She describes her cabin. She tells us that it's an anchor hold of sorts. An anchor hold was a place where an anchoress, a female monastic, solitary monastic, would live attached to a church, like Julian of Norwich. Is anyone here familiar with Julian of Norwich, a 14th century English mystic? Woven into the text are allusions to this woman, Julian of Norwich, who lived in the 14th century in the town of Norwich, England. Annie Dillard, in this case, is making a parallel between her life in her cabin and this anchoress, hermit, monastic. In this case, her life isn't fastened to a church, but to God's creation, at the fringy edge where elements meet and realms mingle, as she describes it, where time and eternity spatter each other with foam. She talks about, she establishes certain metaphorical boundaries. She talks about salt and fire. Armenians, I read, salt their newborn to consecrate them, as did the Israelites, and does the Roman Church. And this information makes her playful. She says, I salt my breakfast eggs. All day long, I feel created. The fire that she mentions is linked to death, but also to creativity and to sacrifice. Her entry point is a spider's web and leads to the description that we're going to read. So for the moment, I'll set that aside and we'll come back to it. In part two, we meet the conundrum of suffering. A plane falls from the sky, and Julie Norwich, 7 years old, burnt off her face, as she said. She describes very briefly, she outlines how the child was riding in a plane with her father. The plane accidentally fell to the ground. Her father pulled her out of the plane, and for somehow burning fuel ignited her face, and her face was burnt off. So we have here the situation of a young child, through no fault of her own, being critically injured in a way that's particularly horrifying. And in Julie Norwich's face, we're confronted with the pain that ignites Dillard's furious challenge to the gods and to God. She calls life the best joke there is, a joke less like the banana peel than the rake, the old rake in the grass, the one you step on foot to forehead. And part two continues in a very bitter vein as she attempts to make sense of what happened to Julie. But in this, she's also drawing a parallel to herself, the artist. She discovers that though fame has made her known, she doesn't understand what her identity is. In a way, both the child and herself find themselves faceless, their identity questioned. And so what Julie's injury does is not only give her develop questions about God's relationship to the world and the question of suffering, but also brings up all of her pain about who she is as an artist and what the dedicated life that she set for herself is like. So she wrestles with this question, and we get a lot of interior dialogue. She suggests, well, perhaps life is not really real. Perhaps this millstone of time is illusion, for only the good is real, for God is spirit and worlds his flimsiest dreams. And she wrestles with Neoplatonic ideas that we simply emanate from God and there's no real connection, or pantheistic ideas where the thing is spirit and there's nothing not distinguishing it. And then we come to the crux of her inquiry, which is whether God touches anything, is anything firm, or is time on the loose? Did Christ descend once and for all to no purpose in a kind of divine and canonic suicide? or ascend once and for all, pulling his cross up after him like a rope ladder home. And she wants to know that there is some connection between God and the gods of the day, or the holiness that she had encountered earlier. The third section, on the third day, Dillard focuses on the body of Christ, both in as the mystical body of Christ gathered for worship. She describes going to church and what that experience is like. She has a vision of Christ's actual body on the beach. And then she also describes the mystical body, which is the world redeemed. Let me read just a short portion from her vision, which ultimately satisfies for her the question. She's walked to the general store to buy wine for communion. She's returning, and she looks out on the beach, and she sees a vision of Christ being baptized. She says, "He lifts from the water. Water beads on his shoulders. I see the water in balls as heavy as planets, a billion beads of water as weighty as worlds, and he lifts them up on his back as he rises. He stands wet in the water. Each one bead is transparent, and each has a world, or the same world, light and alive and apparent inside the drop. It is all there ever could be, moving at once, past and future, and all the people. I deepen into a drop and see all that time contains, all the faces and deeps of the worlds, and all the world earth's contents, every landscape and room, every living or made being, every living or made or fashioned, all past and future stars, and especially faces, faces like the cells of everything, faces pouring past me, talking and going and gone, and I am gone." For her in this encounter, this vision of Christ being baptized propels her into a discussion, to suggest to her that indeed God is in some way in touch with the world in a way that she was striving to understand. And that she encapsulizes this by using a concept which she borrows from esoteric Christianity, a rather archaic concept called Holy the Firm, hence the title of the book. Holy the Firm occurs, she discovers, in the waxy deepness of planets, but never on the surface of planets where men could discern it, and it is in touch with the absolute at base. So what Dillard has done is had an experiential encounter with God in the world, and the way she uses to describe it is this notion from esoteric Christianity, Holy the Firm. But for her, not everything is yet resolved. She still has to understand how it is to be an artist living in the world, and whether her life dedicated to art and the sacrifices she makes for art are at all meaningful. I'm not going to tell you what she decides, at least not yet, because what I'd like to do is return to her segment about which describes her encounter with a golden moth burning in a candle. I brought along copies of that, and what I thought we could do is read it out loud to one another. Because this is so poetic, listening to it first before we read it, before we read it to ourselves, may give you a different experience of it. So what I thought we could do is read it paragraph by paragraph, passing around this copy, and then I'll give you your own copy to read, and we can read it silently and do some closer textual analysis of it.
Start by reading,
mm-hmm.
and read however many paragraphs you're comfortable with, and then pass it
on
to the next person.
I live on northern Puget Sound in Washington State, alone. I have a gold calf who sleeps on my legs, named Small. In the morning, I joke to her blank face, "Do you remember last night? Do you remember?" I throw her out before breakfast so I can eat. There is a spider, too, in the bathroom with whom I keep a sort of company. Her outfit always reminds me of a certain moth I helped to kill. The spider herself is of uncertain lineage, bulbous at the abdomen and drab. Her 6-inch mess of web works, works somehow, works miraculously, to keep her alive and me amazed. The web itself is in a corner behind the toilet, connecting the wall to the tile wall and floor in a place where there is, I would have thought, scant traffic. Yet under the web are 16 or so corpses she has tossed to the floor. The corpses appear to be mostly sow bugs, those little armadillo creatures who live to travel flat out in houses and die around. There is also a new shred of earwig, 3 old spider skins crinkled and clenched, and 2 moth bodies, wingless and huge and empty. Moth bodies I drop to my knees to see. One more. Today the earwig shines darkly and gleams. What there is of him. A dorsal curve of thorax and abdomen and a smooth pair of cerci, C-E-R-C-I, by which I knew his name. Next week, if the other bodies are any indication, he will be shrunken and gray, webbed to the floor with dust. The sow bugs beside him are hollow and empty of color, fragile, a breath away from brittle fluff. The spider skins lie on their sides, translucent and ragged, their legs drying in knots. And the moths, the empty moths, stagger against each other, headless, in a confusion of arcing strips of chitin, like peeling varnish, like a jumble of buttresses for cathedral domes, like nothing resembling moths, so that I should hesitate to call them moths, except that I have had some experience with the figure moth reduced to a nub.
Thank you.
Should I pass it on?
Sure. Bruce?
I'll start in the middle.
Two summers ago, I was camped alone in the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. I had hauled myself and gear up there to read, among other things, James Ramsey Allman's The Day on Fire, a novel about Rimbaud that I made me want to be a writer when I was 16. I was hoping it would do it again. So I read, lost every day, sitting under a tree by my tent, while warblers swung in the leaves overhead and bristle worms trailed their missions over the creaky dirt at my feet. And I read every night by candlelight while barred owls called in the forest and pale moths masked around my head in the clearing where my light made a ring. Moths kept flying into the candle. They would hiss and recoil, lost upside down in the shadows among my cooking pans. Or they would singe their wings and fall, and their hot wings, as if melted, would stick to the first thing they touched, a pan, a lid, a spoon. So that the snag moths would flutter only in tiny arcs, unable to struggle free. These I could release by a quick flip of a stick. In the morning I would find my cooking step gilded with torn flecks of moth wings, triangles of shiny dust here and there upon the aluminum. So I read and boiled water and replenished candles and read on. One night a moth flew into the candle, was caught, burned dry, and held. I must have been staring at the candle. Or maybe I looked up when a shadow crossed my page. At any rate, I saw it all. A golden female moth, a biggish one with a 2-inch wingspan, flat into the fire, dropped her abdomen into the wet wax, stuck, flamed, frazzled, and fried in a second. Her moving wings ignited like tissue paper, enlarging a circle of light in a clearing, and creating out of the darkness the sudden blue sleeves of my sweater, the green leaves of jewel weed by my side, the ragged red trunk of a pine. At once the light contracted again and the moth's wings vanished in the fine, foul smoke. At the same time, her 6 legs clawed, curled, blackened, and ceased, disappeared utterly. And her head jerked in spasms, making a spattering noise. Her antennae crisped and burned away, and her heaving mouth parts crackled like crystal fire. When it was all over, her head was gone. So far as I could determine, gone a long way up her wings and legs. Had she been new or old? Had she mated? An laid her eggs, and she done her work. All that was left was a glowing corn shell of her abdomen and thorax, a frame partially collapsed, gold tube jammed upright, and the candles round cool.
And then this moth essence, this spectacular skeleton, began to act as a wick. She kept burning. The wax rose in the moth's body from her soaking abdomen to her thorax, to the jagged hole where her head should be, and widened into a flame, a saffron-yellow flame that robed her to the ground like any emulated monk. That candle had two wicks, two flames of identical height, side by side. The moth's head was fire. She burned for 2 hours until I blew her out. She burned for 2 hours without changing, without bending or leaning, only glowing within, like a building fire glimpsed through silhouetted walls, like a hollow saint, like a flame-faced virgin gone to God, while I read by her light, kindled, while Rimbaud in Paris burnt out his brains in 1,000 poems, while night pulled wetly at my feet.
And that is why I believe those hollow crisps on the bathroom floor are moths. I think I know moths and the fragrance of moths and chips and tatters of utterly empty moths in any state. How many of you, I asked the people in my class, which of you want to give their lives and to be writers? I was trembling from coffee or cigarettes or the closeness of faces all around me. Is this what we live for, I thought? Is this the only final beauty, the color of any skin in any light and living human eyes? All hands rose to the question. You, Nick? Will you? Margaret? Randy? Why do I want them to mean it? And then I tried to tell them that you can't be anything else. You must go at your life with a broad axe. They had no idea what I was saying.
I have two hands, don't I? And all this energy for as long as I can remember. I'll do it in the evenings after skiing or on the way home from the bank or after the children are asleep. They thought I was raving again. It's just as well. I have three candles here on the table, which I disentangle from the plants and light from visitors come. Small, usual, laborious end. Although once she came too close and her tail caught fire, I rubbed it out before she noticed. The flames move light over everyone's skin, draw light to the surface of the faces of my friends. When the people leave, I never blow the candles out. After I'm asleep, they flame.
Thank you.
Before we take a closer look at that, what images stick in your mind? What spoke to you? That reading.
Well, the candle, I think.
Mm-hmm. The candle.
And then the three lights.
Right, and the reprise of the three lights on the table.
But also your close observation of it. It's just something like a spider web.
All that detail.
All the things that were in it and under it.
Right.
And right. Having seen good. Such ourselves.
Mm-hmm. The description of the moth burning in the flame. I'd like to give you each a copy of this
and then a couple minutes to look over it for yourselves. So if you think a little bit more about what we've found here, that you're going to unpack it.
For starters, let's be clear about what she's talking about. There are actually three different locales that she's talking about and four different incidents. The initial one is in her cabin where she's describing the spider web behind the toilet. The second takes place when, in Virginia, some years prior. Thirdly, she's suddenly talking about her writing class taking place, we're not quite sure in what time, but presumably someplace different from the cabin that she's talking about, a different time and a different place. And then lastly, she segues back to her cabin and she's describing the three candles on the table. In that first description, Paul, you mentioned the kind of detail, that sort of scientist's observation. What's the effect of that sort of natural history observation on, for you? What does it do? I don't have an
extremely in touch with all of life around her. Detail. I'm an extremely sensitive person. It seems to me no preoccupation with
other things. Very focused.
Focus.
Uh-huh. It's very physical. It's very tactile.
I don't think I would recognize it. It blows off the whole thing. You mean you didn't find it, you didn't see it?
The other thing that's pervasive about it is it's kind of a scene of all the dead bodies.
Right.
So
right.
It's the, just the whole collection of
corpses.
Corpses, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, like a morgue.
Good description. Right. Although she tells us that her web works. The spider's web to keep her alive, so that together we have this pile of corpses, but it's the spider's handiwork that keeps her, it's her sustenance at the same time. Do you think she has a strong reaction to the death those questions of death. To me, it's rather a clinical observation.
And my sense was it's a very matter-of-fact description.
Matter-of-fact, yes.
This is a very ordinary kind of thing.
It's, right.
Except she would observe this, it's not ordinary, but this is happens all over.
Right, yeah.
Kind of just the nature of things.
Right, sort of the nature of the way things are. Yeah. Notice some of her language in the last paragraph of that first section where she describes the moths in a confusion of arcing strips like the jumble of buttresses for cathedral domes. And here's the first place that she started to introduce some imagistic language that's associated with the sacred. So, just to note. So then what's happening in that second section where she starts out, two summers ago, I was camping alone. Why she go there? What's she searching for?
To try to do writing.
To try to write. To try to want to write again. Who's she reading about?
The little one fighter.
Right, about Rimbaud. Anybody know much about Rimbaud?
Mm-mm.
Well, I always think of him as a dissolute French poet of some brilliance. In fact, she gives reference to Rimbaud burning out his brains in Paris.
He was sort of a juvenile to one composer, subsequently became. I can picture him in the Greenwich City in the 60s. I mean, just very.
Bohemian.
Yeah.
Yeah, the quintessential bohemian. So that's an interesting model that she's chosen for herself. In fact, this is factual. She wrote an essay describing how she came to write this, and it is surprisingly factual for her. She takes great liberties often with events. In this case, she's very selective about what she's going to tell us, but this really happened. She really did go on a camping trip, and she really did have this experience with the moth. Again, we get some description. Warblers, bristleworms, barred owls, pale moths. But we're moving into something that's much more imagistic and metaphoric. The moth and the candle. Now, she describes a number of moths flying into her candles and getting brushed off and losing their wings and leaving little pieces of silver around on her stuff. But one night, a moth flew into the candle, was caught, burnt dry, and held. Now, how does she describe this one? What happened to this creature? Well, first of all, how does she describe it? What kind of a moth is it?
A golden female.
Does it help you to know that Annie Dillard has long blonde hair? All right, a small detail maybe I should drop into the conversation. A biggish one that stuck into the wet wax, stuck, flamed, frazzled, and fried in a second. What does that description of the moth do for you? How does that strike you?
Gross.
There must have been some substance there.
Good.
Because it became a wick.
It became a wick,
yeah.
Right. It lost its wings, it lost its head, it's lost its feet, but the body stays embedded in this candle wick. I imagine that everyone has a very clear visual image of this. It elicits for me something, a very strong picture of what has happened. We've probably seen something similar to it. But you're right, so it's stuck in the wick, and it burns along with the flame. She notes that the wax rose widened into a flame, which she describes as a saffron-yellow flame that robed her to the ground like any immolating monk.
What's she referring to there? What she's talking about, emulating locks?
Well, it evidently created quite a flame in the process of burning.
Right, right. Does that image draw to mind any newsreels from the 60s and the Vietnam War?
Yeah, it reminds me of that.
Right, the burning monks who burned themselves in their saffron robes to protest the war, the Buddhist monks. Right. So she's drawing there a close parallel between this moth that she sees in her attempt to want to write again and the monks who really pushed the Buddhist concept of nonviolence to its limits by killing themselves so strongly that they feel about the issue of peace. So it's the prototypical sacrificial act of the monks. She goes on to say that she, meaning the moth and the moth body in the flame, burned for 2 hours without changing, without bending or leaning, only glowing within. Like a building fire glimpsed through silhouetted walls, like a hollow saint, like a flame-faced virgin gone to God, while I read by her light, kindled, while Rimbaud in Paris burnt out his brains in 1,000 poems, while night pooled wetly at my feet. So what are the various elements that she's got in there? She's got the moth. It's like a building fire. Hollow saint. Flame-faced virgin gone to God. And Annie Dillard reading. And Rimbaud. So they all get drawn together in this one image of the moth body and the candle.
Seems to me that she is thinking about fueling her own light with the fire of some sacrifice for that which
good.
Is just and right.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
That must be good.
Very much she feels that.
Sure.
Right. Now the flame-faced virgin gone to God, and also the moth, whose face is extinguished in the flame, is prologue to the second chapter where the plane falls out of the sky and little Julie Norwich has her face burnt off. So she's drawing together her own sacrificial life of writing and the artist's life, this moth and little Julie Norwich.
I sort of wonder if she very graphically describes what happens to the moth as it goes into the flame.
Yeah.
And the moth ceases to exist except for a conduit for this flame.
Very good.
And is she implying that in making the sacrifices to be a writer or whatever, that she becomes more intolerant?
Exactly. Exactly. I think that's what she's trying to suggest, or that she's wrestling with. Where is individual identity in this? The question of losing one's face, sort of where our identity lies, our recognition. Exactly. I think she's wrestling with that question of that self-emptying gesture of sacrifice.
Yeah, kind of the kenosis theory of the Bible studies from.
Oh, really? She
was
talking about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. Good. Good for weaving that in. Well, then, what she segues into immediately, what does she go to next?
Her writing class.
Her writing class, exactly. And she's trying to say, which of you want to give your lives and be writers, just like you said, Bruce? And she's looking at them, all these young people who say, of course, I do. She said, do you mean it? I tried to tell them what the choice must mean. You can't be anything else. You must go at your life with a broad X. They had no idea what I was saying.
So evidently what's in parens there is what they were saying.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Oh, well, I can do it. I'll do it when the kids are in bed. I'll do it on the weekends. Sort of part-time artistry. And Do you think she buys it? Is she making fun of him? Yeah. Because for her, her dedication to her art is total, like you pointed out, that she gives up and becomes a channel for God.
It goes back to the various moths flying in and out of the flame. They're tinkering at this.
Very good.
Yeah. Making the sacrifice necessary.
Right.
Losing little wings.
Right. Yeah. And then to that fourth piece where she says, I have three candles here on the table. The flames move light over everyone's skin, draw light to the surface of the faces of my friends. Her talk about illumination here is picked up again later in her book, where she talks about an artist as one who brings illumination. She writes later, what can an artist set on fire but his world? What can any people bring to the altar but all it has ever owned in the thin towns or over the desolate plains? The artist's face is flame like a seraph's, lighting the kingdom of God for the people to see. His life goes up in the works, his feet are waxen and salt. He is holy and he is firm, spanning all the long gap with the length of his love, in flawed imitation of Christ on the cross, stretched both ways, unbroken and thorned. So must the work be also in touch with, spanning the gap from here to eternity, home. So for her, the artist's work becomes wholly the firm. It makes the connection between God, eternity, and time, or the world. Now the question is, what does this all have to do with suffering and with evil? I think what Dilla's trying to do, and what I would love to hear some discussion from you folks about, is when Dilla looks at the world and the suffering and questions how God has engineered this world so that suffering like this exists, her response to that, her response to evil and suffering, is her sacrificial act as an artist. And what she wants to know is, does this make a difference? Does anyone care? One point she calls artists pyrotechnic fools. Was like Rimbaud burning out their brains, and for what cause? And I think what she's trying to suggest in this book is that what can we do but take the tools or materials that we have at hand in our own lives and give them up? And that her specific work is in the creation of works of beauty. Her writing is exquisite. She's one of the consummate stylists, I think, of our day. But she wants to know that that's enough, and that that's what God is calling her to. And that while beauty, the beauty that she helps create, really isn't a response to evil, it can be a strategy for helping us cope with suffering and evil. If you think about the works of art that you may go to in those moments when nothing else can bear you up, I think that's the kind of thing that she wants to know, that has meaning and purpose, that her art. So I'm interested to know whether you can make connections in your own lives about the kinds of sacrifice, whether it's artistic or whatever it is, the work that you bring to the world, in what way you may see that as a response to suffering, within the context of Annie Dillard's discussion of her trying to be her art as her response to suffering.
Again, be the channel, I think, is a real key. Be the real hinge that she has, right? But there is suffering that I think in one's life. That's certainly from my life, as a perfect parallel, but in the sense that you believe in enough in gifts that God's given you, then no matter whether the world accepts it or not, you've got to share it.
whether or not the world accepts it or not.
And in the still Isaiah 55, as the rains come down from heaven and water the earth, and that thus so shall my word be, it goes from my mouth, which will be returned to me up to you. Well, I believe in what you do, at whatever cost, get it done, be the channel. Take it and be nourished by it, as she knows the light of God.
What kind of consequences are there for living a life like that?
You probably won't be the most happy person. It won't be good.
Have you had that experience? That sort of empty experience? Like the moth being a channel for the wax and the flame? But that's interesting, because it's as if you're suggesting because you enjoyed it, then it wasn't, you weren't emptied by it. I guess I would question. It may be that pleasure's allowed.
I had to work very hard. And maybe that's the emptying out diagnosis. But I enjoy working that.
Right. Anybody else?
I'm thinking of music right now. That's what I was thinking of as I was speaking.
Yeah.
Well, I think that when I first retired, and I was looking around for organizations with which to spend my time doing volunteer work, there were several that I tried out, and I'd get involved in projects, and I just felt they were not very worthwhile. And, I mean, we really just kind of did feel like we were getting burned out.
Being burned out, but not necessarily being a channel for the kind of care or compassionate response.
Yes.
How did you finally choose what it was that you wanted to do?
Well, I guess, it was just a learning procedure to discover the things that weren't meaningful to you, and then to go on to something else, to have the courage to say no and stop and go on to something else.
The courage to say no is a significant one, and I think that's part of what Dylan's talking about in the dedicated life, and that she uses as her model a nun, and specifically refers to Julian of Norwich, but that focus where you say no to a lot of other things in the world, to where you come down to the right thing.
I'm kind of struggling, I guess, the abstract idea of the role of art in society, whether it is enough to lead an artist's life and produce art that in some way you are satisfied yourself with, or whether this needs to contribute to society at large. I think this book is kind of ambiguous on that point.
I think it's a good observation.
Personally, I'm sort of attracted to a life of contemplation or solitude, which may not impact on the world at large. Paul made a comment earlier that you ought to go out and share your gifts, which I don't object to. I'm just not sure. I'm not sure I agree that is a necessary part of art.
Oh, of course not. What Bruce was saying is that he, is
thinking about abstractly, if I've got this right, is being an artist enough? And do you necessarily have to go out and share it? That was one of your comments, that an artist will want to give the gifts to the world.
Yeah.
And you're saying artists don't necessarily do that? Or
yeah,
that may not be part of the package?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
But isn't just the fact that, I'm not sure which form of art you're talking about, but if it's visual art or writing,